arrived the Schwarzschild solution yesterday and talked a little bit about metric around stars and about the fact that if there's just too much matter, it will eventually collapse to form a black hole. Sort of natural thing to do now is to take a little look at black holes. So I know you've already seen some of these things, some properties of black holes, but I want to sort of take what you've done and then push it a little bit further. So the first bit I'm going to talk about causal structure of black holes, and in particular, show you what a Penrose diagram is, how we kind of get to a Penrose diagram in full technicolor detail, and also why they're quite useful in terms of a shorthand of saying, you know, what the structure of a black hole space-time is. Then we'll look at the Kerr metric, which is the rotating black hole metric, and just sort of look a little bit at the properties of that and talk about geodesics around Kerr. Okay, so I'm going to start off by taking the Schwarzschild solution, which is our prototype for a black hole. So this is what we saw, our general spherically symmetric static solution. Was what we saw it looked like this yesterday, where m was officially an integration constant, but we give it the interpretation of mass by doing a sort of weak field approximation and integrating up a sort of diffuse spherically symmetric source. Also, if we go very far away from the black hole and kind of look at geodesics and how those geodesics move or the acceleration of an observer at rest, we would also see that this would be kind of like the Newtonian mass of the object. So we're fairly confident that M is a good label for our black hole mass. So you've already seen our Kruskal coordinates. And so the idea of the Kruskals is that we look at our metric here, we look at its curvature, and we see that although the metric itself is singular at 2 gm, we suspect that's the same sort of singularity as theta equals 0 and pi of polar coordinates. So if you look at the curvature tensor, the only place that the Riemann or the Riemann squared blows up is actually at r equals 0. So there's a strong suspicion that 2 gm is just a coordinate singularity, and that is what Kruskals do. They explicitly sort of demonstrate a set of coordinates that are not singular at 2 gm. So we get to Kruskals via what's sometimes called the tortoise coordinate. So I'm just going to replace 2 gm by r plus, just because it's quicker to write. And you, first of all, you define a coordinate r star such that the tr piece of the metric is now a single factor times dt squared minus dr squared. So r star is the appropriate radial coordinate for null geodesic. So light rays will be at T plus or minus R star is a constant. The crustals then, are taken to be, we exponentiate these sort of the immediate naive sort of null coordinates, T plus or minus R star. So those are our crustals. And then we see, if we take du dv, well, if we take either du or dv, du is simply u times, if we look at the exponential, it's d of t minus r star divided by minus 2r plus. So that's where we get this from. And then I can substitute what uv is. If I multiply u by v, the t part vanishes, and I just get e to the r star over r plus from my exponential. The prefactors of r plus squared cancel with this. And so I end up just with the exponential of r star. But then if I look up to see what r star is, r star has a log in it, and it's a log of r minus r plus. So now we see where the event horizon, this 1 minus 2 gm on r, comes in. And so when I multiply through, I end up with this piece that looks like it's been lifted straight off the Schwarzschild metric. So you've kind of seen this before. U and V are null coordinates, so we draw them at 45 degrees. And we then have to identify our event horizon. So if I ask where my event horizon is at r equals r plus, so this r minus r plus vanishes, but that came from the product uv. So if we're sitting on the event horizon, uv is zero. If we say, what is our origin? Well, at the origin, so this prefactor here was, this was our uv. So if I set r equals zero, I simply end up with r plus squared. I have to be a little cautious because of the branch of the logarithm, but basically this is what I get. And then if I want to identify constant timelines, then I have to divide u and v. So if I now translate that into my picture, if uv is zero along the line u equals zero, and v equals zero, so this is r equals r plus. Lines of constant r are hyperbole. Uv is constant, so this would be a line of constant r. And then at r equals 0, uv is positive, so that is in these two quadrants. So this is my singularity. And then t equals constant is just a straight line. So that's my coordinate system. So the Schwarzschild coordinates live in here. They just deal with this one quadrant of the plane. But if I use these null coordinates, u and v, I can not only extend across my event horizon, I sort of see that the full maximally continued, analytically continued space-time is actually an awful lot bigger. I go through, there's another sort of mirror event horizon here, and I end up in another asymptotically flat regime. I've also, slightly more worryingly, got a past image of my singularity. And sometimes this surface here is called a white hole in the sense that all the null geodesics are kind of outgoing. So typically, this is not something that we would put into a physical black hole space-time. But nonetheless, as an exact solution of general relativity, it's static, which means it's time reversal symmetric. So I know you've seen that picture before, because a little bird told me. But when we draw a black hole, we usually want, this is sort of a, although it's a useful picture, it's not compact. So our u and v coordinates go off to infinity. So what we want to do, or what we tend to do, is that we compactify, we sort of squeeze in our picture so that it all fits on onto a single sheet of paper, and that's what the Penrose diagram is. It's a way of encoding the key aspects of the causal structure of the space-time all in one neat little diagram. So how do we get it? Well, if we want to squeeze an infinite coordinate range into some finite range, then a neat way of doing it is to use arctan, because tan takes minus pi on 2 into minus infinity to plus infinity. And so here, if these coordinates have or vary along the reals, my p and q are going to lie in minus pi on 2 and pi on 2. So that now sort of shrinks my black hole picture into a finite size. So when v is 0, p is 0. When v is r plus, p is pi on 4. And when v is tends to infinity, p tends to pi on 2. So with the same sort of relations for you. So you can see the sort of important values of the p and q variables. The other thing that's useful is if I use my trig addition formulae for tangent and I re-express it in terms of u and v, I see that when uv is r plus squared, in other words, at r equals 0, this bottom line tends to 0. In other words, this tangent becomes infinite. So r equals 0 corresponds to p plus q is plus or minus pi on 2. So now I've sort of identified the key limits of these p and q variables. So if I now sketch my P and Q space, so this would be P, this is Q. So on the right-hand side, if I look at that right-hand quadrant, that's on that right-hand quadrant, V ranges from 0 to infinity, and U ranges from minus infinity to 0. So my P coordinate goes from 0 to pi on 2, and my Q coordinate goes from minus pi on 2 to 0. So this is my right-hand quadrant up there. So this is our Schwarzschild space, or represents our Schwarzschild space. Then, which means, I know I've got an image over here, then I say, okay, so I know this is my event horizon. So where's the singularity? Well, the singularity is P plus Q is pi on 2 or minus pi on 2. In other words, this line here. So now I've reduced my Schwarzschild black hole down to a single sort of compact diagram which encodes the full causal structure of my space-time. So this is what we call a Penrose diagram, sometimes Penrose-Carter. And so key things that you look for on a diagram are the squiggly lines, which are singularities. You look for any sort of boundary like this, which tends to be a horizon of some sort. Whether it's a white hole or a black hole one. And then we have to sort of say, aha, but what about these other lines at 45 degrees? So rather than discuss them in the case of the Schwarzschild black hole, I'm going to just quickly look at Minkowski space-time to identify what they are. So this encodes causal structure. So it's worthwhile, actually, just doing Minkowski because it's a very simple space that's flat. So in this case, our radial light rays are just at T plus R or T minus R equals constant. And since R is positive, that tells you that V has to be bigger than or equal to U. So in other words, if I sketched my UV space, I sort of throw away R less than zero. So if I now think what's V has to be bigger than or equal to U, that's tan P is bigger than or equal to tan Q. So from my compact coordinates, what that means is I shrink the whole of the range down to this little triangle. So this is P and that's Q. So let's just think about what these various parts of this diagram are. If I look at this surface here, then any light ray, radial light ray, will, so if I this if I sketch a null ray that comes in from infinity, it goes through r equals zero. So from the perspective of this diagram, this would be a null ray. So remember, we have suppressed theta and phi. So you, a light ray comes right into the origin, and it just carries on. But of course, what it carries on is r goes down to zero, r becomes positive again, but you've gone to the opposite, the antipodal point. So theta's sort of gone to pi minus theta, and phi has gone to phi plus pi. So this is just a radial light ray. And so any light ray in Minkowski space will end up on this surface here. So we call this surface, we sort of denote it by the script I, which we call scry. And this one we call future null infinity because it represents the end point of all the future null geodesics. Similarly, this one, scry minus, is past null infinity because the past boundary of all null rays is scry minus. So you have, you know, in flat space-time, a null geodesic comes in from infinity and goes out to infinity. And so you have the past boundary, the past null boundary, where all of those null geodesics started from, that's scry minus. And then you have a future null boundary, which is where all the geodesics end up on. So that's scry plus and scry minus. What about these points? Well, if you're not a null geodesic, you won't end up on scry. And if you're a time-like geodesic, you will start out here and you will end up there. So this is past time-like infinity. And this one is I plus, which is future time-like infinity. And then this little thing sitting in there, we call I naught, which is space-like infinity. So our infinity suddenly has a lot of structure. It's not sort of out there. It's something that we can at least represent by one of these diagrams. So if I now come back here and just think, what does that mean from the perspective of the black hole? Well, if I'm somewhere over here, if I'm some observer, and I shine a torch, then if I shine a torch away from the black hole, my null geodesic will reach this scry plus. If I shine a torch into the black hole, then my light ray will hit the singularity. As for my own fate, well, as long as I burn the rockets enough, I can avoid going into the black hole. I'm always on a time-like geodesic, so my world line can never go beyond 45 degrees, but I can keep my world line with a tangent vector less than 45 degrees and still reach future time-like infinity. However, if you are at r less than r plus, sitting in here, your world line has to have an angle less than 45 degrees. So it has to lie always within this light cone here. And so you see that if once you go inside r equals 2gm, whether you are a null, a massless particle, or a massive particle, you will always hit r equals zero. So that's why this encodes the causal structure of the black hole. It's sort of telling you that this is the boundary between things that can escape and things that can't. And it just encodes it in a very nice, visual, and accurate manner. So that's what Penrose diagrams are, and they're very useful.
I see it's mathematical, but not understand it maybe. How is that R equals 0 here a vertical line and there a horizontal line? And
because once you go inside the event horizon in Schwarzschild, if you look at, I know you shouldn't use those coordinates inside, right? But it's useful. It's a useful way of explaining it. If you look at that top metric and go to R less than 2gn, t becomes a space-like coordinate and r becomes a time-like coordinate. So inside the Schwarzschild black hole, the singularity is therefore space-like because r is now a time-like coordinate, which means surfaces of r equals constant are space-like surfaces. So here, it's because the nature of T and R, if you like, is swapped as you've gone across the event horizon. So whereas here, nothing untoward is happening, and T always remains your time coordinate, and R is always a spatial coordinate. So that's why R equals constant looks time-like in this sense.
So would you say that the singularity is at the center of the black hole or at the future?
So, both. So both, you know, in the sense that it's, you know, to some extent, talking about what happens behind the horizon is a little bit dodgy anyway. But from our perspective, you know, the black hole is spherical. So if we interpret the singularity as being at the origin, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, because it is, you know, sort of equidistant in some sense. On the other hand, it's, you know, it's also, as you say, it is also a space-like singularity. So, yeah.
Why is it possible for R plus and R equals 0 to intersect?
Why is it possible for
R equals R plus and R equals 0 to intersect, like at the top?
Oh, right. Well, because in some sense this, so the I'm not sort of, right. So this is kind of a singular point in terms of this coordinate transformation. So, you know, as you go towards scry, you're going towards, if you look at the definition of the coordinates here, you're taking an infinite range of your real physical coordinate, in a sense, is what V is, and you're squishing it down into a finite range. So that's that is a singular conformal transformation. So that point there is, you know, from the perspective of the transformation you have done, is a very singular point. Nonetheless, it kind of makes sense to identify it as a sort of endpoint of geodesics, but perhaps to, you know, to say it's completely linked to R equals zero. I suppose it is in some sense, because if you imagine sort of observers that are getting sort of incrementally close to the event horizon and sort of what's their asymptotic future, if they're just outside, they escape to I0. If they're just inside, they get squashed at R equals zero. But again, you could imagine, you know, them being just inside R equals 2gm and, you know, you fire your rockets at maximal, you know, you've got some infinite energy source, so you're maximally accelerating, trying to get away from the singularity. From the technical perspective of geodesics, you can do that, and so you can skim ever closer to R equals 2gm on each side. So you can kind of see how there is a sense of continuity there, although in terms of what your ultimate fate is, it's very, very different. So in reality, pretty much every sort of astrophysical object has rotation. You know, our galaxy rotates, our sun rotates, we go around the sun. Angular momentum, it just is. And so although the Schwarzschild solution is incredibly useful and it illustrates all the key features of a black hole, we don't really think it's what represents the black holes that are out there. So the real thing that we should be using is a solution that includes rotation, and that is called the Kerr metric. So let me just write it down. Okay, so it's a bit more complicated than Schwarzschild. What you first notice about it is it has a cross term, dt d phi. So if a black hole is rotating, if you think about, you know, what rotation does, it sort of breaks this time symmetry. So if you time reverse something, you would expect it would rotate in the opposite direction. So if you look at this here, you can kind of see that in that cross term. So A, which is the angular momentum divided by the mass of the black hole, A is telling you about the rotation. So A is a rotation parameter. Then if you kind of look at GTT, it's sort of a bit like it looks a little bit like your Schwarzschild potential. But it's changed in that it now depends on the theta coordinate. So what it's saying is that if a black hole rotates, now things depend not just on R, but also on where you are in terms of that theta angular coordinate. So I'm saying it's a black hole. So the things that, you know, the properties that we should just at least explore are, where's the event horizon? Can we easily see where the event horizon is? And are there any other interesting surfaces? So the reason I wrote it, sort of rearranged the terms from this first expression to the second one, is that here I've kind of grouped everything together into an orthonormal basis. Now, of course, that's not unique, but at least what it's doing is it's kind of giving you some clue about where the event horizon might be. So the job of the sort of rest of the lecture is to identify precisely where the event horizon is, and also where other interesting things happen in this rotating black hole. So first of all, let me just notice that here, this is some radial, or we're going to kind of associate it as a radial coordinate, because if I set A to 0, I get the Schwarzschild solution where this is my radius R. So that's our first thing to note. A goes to 0 gives a Schwarzschild, so You know, that's kind of comforting. Well, I don't honestly know how Kerr did it, but there are various ways that you can get it. I think when you say trick, there's actually something called a Newman Janus. They don't call it a trick. There's a fancy name for it, which is just escaping me at the moment in my slightly
travel state.
But so you can get, so the way the Newman Janus trick is sort of complexifies the space and does a little rotation. So you kind of complexify a manifold, do a little rotation, and then project back into a, and so that's one. So the A kind of shows up as a sort of complex rotation. But it's, I mean, here I'm writing it in this format because I'm emphasizing the link to Schwarzschild. But I think, probably should have at some point actually tried to dig into how Kerr did it, but you can kind of get it by sort of, trying to remember, I think you can get it by taking sort of flat space and then you have some, you sort of add a piece with built from null vectors. I'm just trying to remember this. And so there are sort of solution generating techniques which I think was how he got it in the first place. But, you know, during the, I guess, from the 60s onwards, finding exact solutions kind of became quite the industry. And so people did a lot of work on classifying the sorts of symmetries your space-time could have and finding the most general solutions in those cases, because of course it didn't have nice big computers to put it on, so you had to do things analytically. If you want to do stuff analytically, you need symmetry. So it's a case of classifying all the possible solutions with given symmetries. So for example, spherical SO3 symmetry. SO3 symmetry doesn't mean you're static a priori, but if you go through and you do exactly what I did yesterday with Cartan, but add in time dependence, it's a bit more complicated, but actually not that much more complicated. You run through, you find your Einstein equations, and you then look for solutions of the Einstein equations, you find they're exactly integrable, and you end up with Schwarzschild, or Schwarzschild de Sitter, or whatever, depending if you have a cosmological constant. So that's called a Birkhoff theorem. So if you have SO3 symmetries, you have a Schwarzschild black hole. So there are things that's just an example. If you step back a bit and have slightly less symmetry, then you can have more, you know, more in complicated solutions and more involved solutions. So if you have, for example, not rotation, but axisymmetry, so drop down from SO3 to a U1 plus your static d by dt, you can then find whole classes of axisymmetric solutions that kind of patch together different black holes. So you can have two black holes, two black holes, which are sort of held apart, you know, held in equilibrium by strings. You can have accelerating black holes. You can have arrays, but you know, so it's not a unique solution, but it's nonetheless, you know, there's sort of an obvious family of solutions. So there was this big industry. So I mean, this was sort of one of the, you know, one of the main, I think, the most important output from that particular industry, because this is really what we expect of the, say, the black hole at the center of our galaxy. So this is, I mean, although Schwarzschild's much easier and much nicer, Kerr really is what we think models are black holes.
Would we expect Kerr or Kerr-Neumann?
So, well, we don't really expect our black holes to be charged. I mean, because because essentially the universe is fairly neutral. I mean, a microscopic charge, right?
Yeah.
But we know that, you know, if we try and put too much charge on a black hole, then you just simply, you know, the electric field becomes too strong and you get pair production. So you never actually get to a significant, I think it's about a sort of race charge mass ratio of about 10 to the minus 19 or something. So it's, you never get a significant charge.
And make it singularity?
Sorry?
Naked singularity.
Ah, now that's an interesting one because, so that's a whole other story. Let me just finish this story first and then you can red herring me afterwards. right, delta equals zero. So at delta equals zero, that's one of our problem points, right? We sort of see dr squared on delta here. So it's a bit like dr squared on 1 minus 2gm on r. So we know delta equals zero is a singularity in the metric. And then we query, is it a horizon? So that's sort of making our first step. Then this, I'll just say this is that r plus or minus is gm plus or minus root g squared m squared minus a squared. So the other interesting point is where gtt vanishes. So if I ask what is the norm of d by dt, so if I am an observer again in my rocket and I start getting closer and closer to the black hole, but I've got sort of someone over, I'm sending my messages back, and what I want to do is to go into sort of to always try and keep myself relatively at rest with respect to an asymptotic observer. So I'm not an inertial frame, and my tangent vector is proportional to d by dt. So I'm an accelerating observer, but I'm trying to keep at rest relative to infinity. What's the size of my tangent vector? Well, it's proportional to 1 minus 2gmr over this sigma. And so this tends to zero when this combination tends to zero. So for example, at theta equals pi on 2, that's at 2gm, which is bigger than the outer zero of delta. So, is this the event horizon? This could be the event horizon. So these are the sort of, these are the features that we need to explore. So in order to do that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at geodesics in the Kerr background. I'm not going to do it in full detail because they're actually quite fun and quite complicated, but I'm going to sort of look at a very special case, which is a little more manageable. And that is to look at geodesics in the equatorial plane. So the equatorial plane is going to slice through my black hole completely symmetrically, and so I expect that that's a sort of self-consistent thing to do. So I'm going to present how you would find geodesics in the equatorial plane. So the first thing I need are some conserved quantities. So whenever I want conserved quantities, I always tend to go back to a Killing vector. So remember, a Killing vector satisfies that the symmetric covariant, symmetrized covariant derivative vanishes. Then let me consider the quantity k dotted with the tangent vector of my geodesic along the world line. So, The first term gives me zero because the killing vector has zero symmetrized derivative, so that's zero. And then the second term, well, this piece is just the geodesic equation, so that's also zero. So what that means is that K dotted with the tangent vector is constant along the geodesic. So I'm doing equatorial geodesic, so I only need worry about three coordinates, t, phi, and r. And I have, Kerr has two Killing vectors. Which are d by dt and d by d phi. So I've got three coordinates to worry about. I've got two conserved quantities, and then I've also got a first integral because the length of my affinely parameterized geodesic is one. So that means it's looking good. I can actually write down a geodesic equation that's a sort of first order equation. So let's see how that goes. So let's think about our first conserved quantity, which I'll call E. So E is k mu x dot mu. So when I lower the index on k, I get gt mu. So this is my E. So the first thing I do is I find out what my first conserved quantity is, which I'm labeling E suggestively because if I have a massive particle, it is kind of related to the energy. And so here, if I go to theta equals pi on 2, my sigma just reduces to r squared. So I get very familiar looking Schwarzschild potential. And sine squared theta is, of course, 1. So that's my E. And for d by d phi, I'm going to call h. Oops. Which is my angular conserved quantity. So that's going to be a sort of angular momentum. And again, in the equatorial plane, this is what it reduces to. So now I'm just going to encode my conserved quantities in a little vector, which just has t and phi components, just for convenience, really. And then p alpha, p beta, G alpha beta, which is the same as taking the T and phi parts of the length, the tangent vector. So this is what I get when I calculate what the length of that p vector is. So here I've simply taken the inverse components of gtt and gtt, gt phi, and g phi phi. So I can regroup this together. Rewriting it. So that's sort of dealt with the parts of the geodesic equation that are related to directions which are symmetries of the metric, so the t and the phi directions. So it's really the analog. Normally, when you're sort of thinking about motion of particles, you sort of try and break it down. You know, for example, when you do geodesics in Schwarzschild, that because Schwarzschild's spherically symmetric, you have a conservation of angular momentum. And so you say, well, okay, whatever my geodesic does, it's got to have constant angular momentum. So I'm going to use that to simplify solving the problem. And since, again, d by dt is a Killing vector for Schwarzschild, you'd say, OK, dt is some sort of Killing vector, therefore I've got a conserved energy. I'm going to use that to help me. Now, in Schwarzschild, those two kind of split apart very neatly. So you just get an E squared and an H squared in terms of when you're analyzing a geodesic. But here, they kind of all mixed up because the black hole's rotating. And so that's why I've had to work just a little bit harder to get that expression. So my geodesic equation is simply, I mean, I can. This is always true with an affinely parameterized geodesic, that the length of the tangent vector is 1 or 0 for the cases we're interested in. But you only ever have to go to the second order expression of the geodesic equation if you don't have enough conserved quantities. But here, we're fine. We've got 3 coordinates, 2 conserved quantities on this relation. So this is all we need. So here, this is reducing to p squared plus grr r dot squared equals eta. And so that's what I have to solve. And I can rewrite this as r dot squared plus an effective potential is 0. So the reason I want to do this is, unless I really, really need to know exactly what the form of a geodesic is, I can get qualitative information about what the geodesics look like by looking at the effective potential. So here, my effective potential has all these different pieces. So let's just kind of identify them. This term here is our Newtonian potential. So if we were doing Newtonian gravity, we would have this piece, this first 2g mR piece. That would still be there. The second bit here, this is like a centrifugal term. So this is attractive. This typically is repulsive. If you didn't have the A, so if we just looked at Schwarzschild, this would just be h squared and r squared. Again, this term would be there in Newtonian gravity. So that's the last term that tells you you're in Einstein gravity, 2g mR cubed. So if I just sketch what's going on with these pieces, as I go to large R, I have a constant, e to minus e squared. The first thing is I start seeing a gravitationally attractive bit, 2m on R. I then hit my centrifugal repulsion barrier, plus on R squared, and then finally, I've got minus an R cubed. Now, this is only qualitative. So here we've got the Newton, and this is the centrifugal bit, and then this is the GR bit. And so, you know, whether or not you get two turning points here, or the exact, you know, whether this one's above that or what, depends on the details. I'm only qualitatively sketching the different regions here so that you get a sort of feel for what this effective potential is. So if you want to know what happens to a geodesic, well, your R dot squared is V effective of R, so it all depends on where the zero line is. So if the zero line is somewhere through here, for example, then this represents orbits that are constrained. So for example, here you would be going between this point and this point. So that would be an elliptical orbit with a nearest point, perihelion, and what's the other one? Perihelion. So a scattering orbit, on the other hand, would look would be where the zero was up here somewhere, okay? Because then you would come in, you'd hit R dot is zero here, and then R would start increasing again. So without solving my geodesic equation, I can actually make statements about what's happening to the solutions. So in particular, there's two special points, is if this is zero, I have a solution, and if that is zero, I have a solution. So those are circular orbits. Because V is zero tells you R dot is zero, and V prime is zero is sort of here. It's telling you you're just simply sitting at that point. This one is stable because there's nowhere for R dot to go. If you try moving it, you're actually making the effective potential positive, and you can't because R dot squared is minus V effective. Up here, though, if this is your zero, that is unstable because you move it to either side and the ball can roll down, so to speak. Now, it's just... So an important feature of black holes is the fact that they, if they don't exist in vacuum, and in particular for stellar black holes, you know, you tend to sort of often see an accretion disk, which is a sort of very, very lively place to be. So you have a sort of whole sort of disk of matter in the equatorial plane that's kind of in long, I mean, it's, eventually it's going to get sucked into the black hole, but it's sort of, you know, metastable. So you have particles sort of orbiting around the black hole, and then gradually, you know, there's a lot, it's a very highly energetic place, a lot of energy is being emitted, so gradually the orbits decay in. But the accretion disk has a definite inside boundary. And so you see this by, as I said, the details of this effective potential depend on the parameter values. But as you sort of change the angular momentum, this maximum and minimum get closer together until they eventually merge. So you get so if you solve for these circular orbits around a black hole, you find, you know, that you've got stable orbit, stable orbit, stable orbit. You gradually drop the radius of your orbit. And this sketch of the effect of potential has these two points coming together until you get a point of inflection beyond which there is no stable orbit. So this is called the innermost stable circular orbit, or ISCO for short. And so that tells you about the innermost radius of the accretion disk. So it's defined by V equals V primed equals V double primed equals zero. And R is 6gm for Schwarzschild. So just to finish off, because I'm running over this time. So that's one important thing about black holes and geodesics around a black hole. So let me just think about a light ray now and ask, come back to this question about the features of the Kerr metric and whether it's delta is zero or GTT equals zero that's the actual event horizon. So for a light ray, I mean, or in general, we require R is bigger than R plus to have to sort of keep, if we look at the definition of our geodesic equation, we've got a GRR, we've got a 1 over delta in it, so we have to keep R bigger than R plus. And we're going to look for a scattering orbit and so here if I look at my effective potential I've got to set eta equal to zero so I now no longer have this Newtonian term instead what I've got for my effective potential is something more like this. And so my scattering orbit will be something that comes in, reaches R dot is zero, and goes back out again. So I need a point where V effective vanishes at some finite R. So for the null, geodesics, set eta equal to zero and ask for a zero of the effective potential. And I've just rescaled E to be 1 here. And I'm going to take, again, to make the maths easy, the extremal limit where GM equals A. So R plus equals R minus. So you solve V effective as zero, and you find that it has a zero at H minus A, and a half A minus H, plus or minus 6 H squared plus 6 AH plus 7 A squared. This one is the outermost solution. So that shows me that if I take H bigger than or equal to 2A, I have a V effective equals 0 for R bigger than or equal to R plus, which is A in this case. So what that means is that it is in fact the zero of delta that's the event horizon, because what I've constructed is a scattering orbit that has a turning point, in other words, closest approach to the black hole, of anything up to and including the zero of delta. So delta equals zero is the event horizon. So what about that other thing? Well, that other thing is where you can no longer be at rest with respect to infinity. So GTT equals zero is the boundary of what we call the ergosphere. Ergos from movement, which is saying that it's no longer possible to stay still. So what that means is the black hole is dragging you around with it. If you get too close, you will be pulled into a co-rotating orbit around the black hole. So we shall stop there before I get beaten up.